We're joined on the programme now by Minister of State for European Affairs, Thomas Byrne. Deputy, thank you. Minister, thank you so much for your time. How are you keeping?
Not too bad, not too bad. It's a lovely day here in Meath. I hope it's similar in Donegal after the bad weather of the weekend.
Yeah, it's catching up, All right, a big year for us, Ireland in the EU. We're assuming the EU presidency in less than 12 months, which means, I suppose, with your portfolio, it's a big year for you too.
Well, look, it's a big year for the country, I think. We're going to take over the presidency of the Council of the European Union in the second half of next year. That's a big moment. There's also a lot of work in the run-up to it. And we'll give an opportunity for the country, first of all, to be driving the EU agenda, which I think is really, really important for us. But also, I suppose, showing people what we can do as a country as well. I think that's really, really important for so many other reasons as well, including reputational and, you know, just trying to show that we are a country that can do things well. I think that's super important.
We're going to talk a bit too about the Communicating Europe initiative. There is a pot of funding there and it has an important job. Talk to me about it.
Well, look, it's a fund that we have that community groups can apply for and that, you know, who want to drive local projects, essentially schools. In fact, some radio stations have applied for funding in the past and got funding in the past. Community groups to run events around communicating what the European Union is about. Now, we've announced the awardees today. Now, there were no applicants from Donegal. Every applicant around the country, actually, except one, actually, succeeded in getting funding. So I'd be really hopeful that organisations in Donegal will apply when we announce the next round of funding, probably towards the end of the year. But that is an important fund. But we're just trying to highlight what the European Union is, what it's about, and to allow communities to take ownership of that.
Do you think there still is a detachment from Europe amongst some, or at least a lack of understanding how everyday life is often impacted by decisions that are taken in Europe? I mean, obviously people would be acutely aware, say, for instance, in this part of the world, Thomas, without getting into the debate about, say, for instance, some negative impacts on the fishing industry or matters like that. But do you think maybe the public, there's a lack of understanding of maybe the what benefits might be there or how there are ongoing sort of positive influences?
Well, I'd never accuse the public of a lack of understanding, that's for sure. The public understand things often better than the politicians. But what I would say about Brussels is that, you know, Letterkenny is the same as Brussels. It's part of the European Union. There are, you know, MEPs elected from all over Ireland. There are governments who go to the Council of Ministers who are represented from all over Ireland. Essentially, it's a democracy. And what I think is the most important thing is to remember that the people that we see and know in the European Union are different from the institutions that they work in. So the European Parliament is really, really important as an institution. And then it's up to us to elect the people. And the same for the Council of Ministers. That comes from the governments of the European Union. We elect the governments in our democracies. The Commission, again, is appointed by the government. So all of this goes back to the people. And I think it's really, really important that people take ownership of it, value the institutions of the European Union, because, you know, with one or two exceptions, and you've named fisheries, but overall, this has been a remarkably positive journey for Ireland over the last number of years. And specifically at this time, we're trying to encourage people to get jobs within the European Union set up, and that is in Brussels or Luxembourg or Strasbourg, or indeed in Dublin and other parts of the European Union as well, there are jobs. Because we want to make sure that we have as many Irish people as possible working there. That's been made, you know, as I should say, first of all, the numbers of Irish people have gone down in recent times. So that's important for us to change that. But it's been made a bit easier since the Irish language has been made an official language of the European Union. And I can go to meetings in Brussels or Luxembourg, use Irish. There are huge opportunities in the European Union for Irish people to get really good jobs. And by and large, doing really, really good work, important work, really for the benefit of humanity. When you think of consumer protection, when you think of environmental protection, when you think of what the European Union is doing, by and large, it is very much to the good.
We'll talk about potential careers in Europe in a moment, but if there are any voluntary organisations, educational bodies, you know, or any sort of projects, I presume they have to have a pro-European angle, Thomas, that would be...
Well, we can't decide on politics, but it is about communicating the European Union, so people should apply.
How do they do so?
Well, the next round will be announced towards the end of this year.
All right, okay.
And be strong... and strongly encouraging organisations in Donegal to apply for funding.
What kind of jobs will be available through the EU general recruitment campaign, which is due to open this autumn? You mentioned, you know, maybe the opportunity for people to use their Irish language. And of course, there's a big cohort that might apply to in our part of the world here in the Northwest. But what kind of experience is required? What kind of jobs do you see popping up?
Well, the jobs pop up in the most extraordinary places. So first of all, is obviously general civil servants who do a huge amount of work in very general areas. But there are also specialists there as well. So scientists, pharmacists, doctors, engineers, agronomists, like agricultural scientists, because obviously the common agricultural policy is so important. And it's surprising when you find the range of employment there. There are obviously a lot of lawyers, a lot of economists in the European Union, but there's also general entry as well. And one of the key things for getting a job is language skills. So we talk about, we obviously speak English, which is an official language of the European Union. Many speak Irish, which is an official language of the European Union. And if you have other language skills, and I mean working language skills, so language at a high level, I think that's a huge advantage. And I think this is a message I want to get out to people as well, that notwithstanding AI, notwithstanding all of the automation that's there, genuine language skills, the ability to work in other languages, is something that's really, really important. Mm-hmm. And if there's any school children or their parents listening, it is so important to maintain those skills. And that will be true into the future. There's no question about that. Yeah. And that's something where we perhaps fall down on slightly.
Closer to home, I think the autumn in the Dáil, one of the big issues is going to be the triple lock. And you'll have plenty to say on that, I am sure. There's a lot out there at the moment. I think your party or the government's accused Sinn Féin of fear-mongering and using misleading and incendiary comments. So I presume that is in the space of the triple lock debate. You're in favour of its adjustment?
Well, yeah, well, we've heard from Sinn Féin this talk about, you know, joining armies or being forced to join armies and fighting Ursula von der Leyen's war, like to exactly quote them. And like, this is just so over the top. It's ridiculous. And it's not fair to be using language like that, to be talking like that, to be putting fear into people like that. I think it's completely wrong. There is no conscription. The EU does not fight wars. There are some countries in the EU who want to protect themselves, and they're absolutely entitled to do that. And also,
but
as
you
a country,
know, there are very powerful people in Europe who would be in favour of a European army, for an example.
There is no proposal whatsoever for a European army, none whatsoever. And essentially, defence policy is still at national level. And there are countries out there making their own decisions, just as we are making our own decisions. And in fact, with removing the triple lock, that's what I'm asking for, is that Ireland would be able to make its own decisions on peacekeeping. Mm. That's all it's about. At the moment, we need the permission, obviously, of the government, of course, Dáil, of course, but we have to go to the UN Security Council as well. And the difficulty there is that we have to ask Russia, because Russia has a veto on any decision of the UN Security Council, along with China and USA.
So could you give me an example of a potential real-world scenario that would benefit us in the absence of the triple lock? So what do you imagine us doing without that Russian veto, to put it like that? What is the potential here?
Well, for example, we don't know if the UNIFIL mission in Lebanon will receive approval by the Security Council, or approval in the way that would suit Ireland at the end of this month. We just don't know. So what happens is then, if the Security Council mandate falls, Irish troops have to leave that day. The same with Bosnia. That's renewed every year in November. If the Security Council mandate falls, our troops have to leave that day. We have a number of troops as well on Operation Irini, which is on the Mediterranean, preventing weapons coming in illegally from Libya. That mandate was only renewed for 6 months there in June because of Russia. And if that mandate falls, we have no legal basis. Now, the reality is that while Irish troops would have to leave, in those cases, the peacekeeping missions would likely continue, because Irini on the Mediterranean was operating before it had a UN Security Council mandate, protecting us from illegal weapons.
Okay, but just pardon my ignorance, Thomas, but what do we want to be doing now that we can't with the triple lock? Now, you're talking about, now, say this were to happen and that could happen and potentially this could happen. What I'm curious of, what, with the triple lock in place, what do we want to do or that we cannot do right now?
Well, let's say at the end of this month, the UNIFIL mandate in Lebanon doesn't pass the
Security Council. Yeah, but we've had the status quo for a very long time. Let's just say it does.
That could change, but that could change in 3 weeks. And in fact, that's been discussed in the media as to whether it might. That mission will continue. Now, what I would like is if that fails at the Security Council, that the Irish government could then, and the Dáil, the democracy here in this country that we vote for, would make its own decision. But at the moment, that decision is out of our hands. We're waiting to see what Russia, America, Britain, and China and France do at the Security Council.
I know it is our democracy, but you talk about the Dáil making the democratic decision. We know also the makeup of the Dáil, the numbers of the Dáil, party whip systems being in place.
But that really is democracy.
Of course it is democracy, yes.
Democracy
would be allowing, I think, members of a party to have a conscious vote or a free vote, but
if the alternative is that we give Russia a conscience vote or a free vote over Irish policy, that's the alternative.
Is it the geopolitical situation has changed? Because you will remember that your own party leader in the current Taoiseach very much argued against Fine Gael tampering with the triple lock. He said it was to the core of our neutrality. So, I mean, and neutrality is a big issue, and that's what Sinn Féin is commenting on. What has changed in 10 years that Micheál Martin was of the view that the triple lock was the core of our neutrality to now? So what's changed that makes that statement no longer stand?
Well, you're absolutely, it's exactly what you said. The geopolitical situation has changed dramatically. So we have had no new peacekeeping missions agreed at the United Nations since 2014. And every time the ones that need renewal come up for renewal at the Security Council, we don't know. So what happens is in the Lebanon, that peacekeeping mission would likely continue at the invitation of the Lebanese government in September if the worst came to the worst. And we don't know that yet. But the Irish contingent would have to leave on that day because there's no legal basis. So the situation has changed dramatically. Russia has invaded Ukraine, and we have
Israel has shot at Irish soldiers.
Absolutely, it's a very dangerous situation, and we're very, very strong about that.
But I don't think the geopolitical situation has changed as much, Thomas, as we're trying to change our position. We're a neutral country, and yet we that is the perception of the population. Yet we aren't politically neutral. That's not a decision that we have made. We are taking very strong stances on geopolitical issues. You know. And this seems to be a further step towards that. I mean, why can we not, in fact, strengthen our neutrality? Why can't we be the peacemakers rather than trying to sort of run with the big boys of Europe?
We're not running with any big boys of Europe. What we're saying is that our foreign policy is dictated, first of all, by our constitution. And our constitution demands that we respect morality, international law, friendly relations among the nations. These are all phrases in the constitution. And To do that, we must uphold the United Nations Charter, which, for example, with Russia and Ukraine, the reason why we're not politically neutral on that at all is because it's a complete breach of the UN Charter. The reason we're so strong in relation to Gaza and Palestine is because we're going back to look at the basic principles of international law and indeed the resolutions of the United Nations Security Council and the General Assembly. But in terms of peacekeeping, we want to be able to make our own decisions, just like every single other country in the world. There are no other neutral countries that have a similar provision to us on the triple lock. And the geopolitical situation, particularly with Russia invading Ukraine and the way they're acting at the Security Council, it's not ideal.
I mean, China and Russia were also a problem back in 2015 when Micheál Martin was dead against any element of this. You know, does the United Nations, though, albeit... sometimes we don't like the decisions of some members. Is that not sort of a very critical part of sort of international relations? You know, and by us foregoing that, we're stepping outside of potentially its important role. As I say, maybe if Russia put in a veto, maybe it is through the offices of the United Nations that we try and reach a peace or we try and negotiate. Is that not the whole ethos of the United Nations? But we're saying stuff that we'll just do whatever the government of the day decides we should do.
No, we're not saying that at all. In fact, completely the opposite. What we're saying is
that's what Micheál Martin also said, by the way. So it's not an original thought.
We're not saying to stuff the United Nations, and we're not saying anything, you know, that would contradict what Micheál Martin says. Russia, the situation with Russia has changed since then dramatically. Our abiding principles on international law and our foreign relations is upholding the UN system, upholding the system of international law, upholding the values of peace and friendly relations among the nations. That's what binds us, and that's what would bind any decision of the government to send peacekeepers abroad. That's the reality. That's the legal basis on which we do it. What we're saying is we need to remove a third leg of a stool, which gives a decision to Russia rather than to the Dáil. And I want that decision fully in the Dáil and fully in the government. And that's all we're trying to do here.
Yeah.
And by the way, Sinn Féin aren't simply saying this is something to do with neutrality. They're saying that it will lead to conscription, that it will lead to... They've talked about their children going to fight foreign wars. This is just complete and utter nonsense. It's baloney, and they know it's nonsense and baloney. But they know it is, and they should be challenged on their exact words, not about some principles of neutrality.
That's what your job and my job is. But the point is though, is it not a case that this might not in and of itself lead to... What Sinn Féin is suggesting, but we don't know. That's how things progress.
What you're suggesting is that an Irish government would take some decision to go off, in the words of Sinn Féin, to fight another man's war or to fight Ursula von der Leyen's war. This type of language is inflammatory. It's designed to whip people up at public meetings. And that is why Sinn Féin, quite frankly, aren't in government, because there's enough of the Irish public know, and as the Sinn Féin TDs who say this know it themselves, this is complete and utter nonsense.
It's been lovely speaking to you, Minister. Thank you very much for your time. Have a great day. Take care. Bye-bye. That is Minister of State for European Affairs, Thomas Byrne. A lot in there. Just in relation to the triple lock, I mean, this is Micheál Martin's views on it not so long ago, 2013.
Earlier this year, Minister Shatter signalled that he would try to water down Ireland's commitment to the triple lock, which is the core of our neutrality. He presented the idea that it was contradictory and we were giving unsavoury countries a veto over our actions. This is an argument which has been behind the efforts of a wing of Fine Gael to erode neutrality over the years.
And on he went. So the very argument, to some extent, that Sinn Féin are making now is a very similar argument to Micheál Martin was making himself. And you can talk about a change in the geopolitical standing, but you heard him reference there the exact same argument that it gives, unsavoury countries, maybe China, maybe Russia, influence that they shouldn't have, but it was there already. But I'm curious, and I suppose it was answered to some extent. What will it permit us to do that we're not already doing? If you know what I'm saying. Okay, any views on that, of course, 086 60 25,000. Anil Anthony is of the Indian community in Letterkenny. He joins me now. Anil, good morning to you.
Hi, Greg. Morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on the program. When did you come here? How long ago is it since you came here? And I suppose, Anil, what were you looking forward to as part of a new life for you and your friends, or maybe even family, in Ireland?
Yeah, Greg, mainly I just want to raise my concerns regarding the recent attacks on the Indian community. Just a bit on my background, I moved to Ireland from Singapore 16 years ago, along with 22 others, to work in IT at Pramerica. In fact, most of us actually accepted an even lower salary compared to what we were earning there, because Ireland was seen as safe and friendly and promising place to settle down.
And what was it like? That's what you came believing it to be. What was it like when you moved here, settling in, and how you were treated?
Yeah, I remember like back then when even the strangers would wave or nod as they passed by, something I hadn't seen anywhere else, So it was like we feel welcomed here, But if you see, Greg, the last 4 or 5 years, there have been a significant change in the way the people see us, And we feel unsafe and unwelcome. Even during election, it was very, very alarming to see that some people seemed to even campaigning against the legal migration here. So you may know yourself, like recently several Indians have been violently attacked, and only a couple of them incidents were reported in the media. If you see, they are well qualified, like Amazon professional, and another one was Dr. Santosh, AI scientist. He suffered a fractured cheekbone. So these all are well-educated people, and yet they were targeted. The situation, Greg, is so serious that the Indian embassy has issued a warning to its citizens in Ireland, something that has never happened before in the last 15 to 20 years.
And you talked about the last 4 or 5 years. We'll give this a little bit of time, if you don't mind. You talked about things changing over the last 4 or 5 years. Just as a member of the Indian community living in Ireland now for almost 2 decades, how does that manifest itself? Is it language? Is it looks? Is it treatment? I mean, when you talk of things getting more difficult in recent years, what is your experience or the experience of your fellow community members?
We see that a lot of people, even the locals, some of the locals are turning against the migrant workers here, you know, because the way people treat and they talk, you know. So I know it may be very a small part of the population here. Majority are still welcoming us, and but it is still alarming, you know, because especially during the election, I see the talks like this happening a lot.
I suspect, and I'm interested in your views on this, I suspect that it's not necessarily that people are becoming more intolerant or racist, for an example, to people like you, Anil. It's that they were always there, but people now feel they have a voice. So in other words, something that you could never have said before without being accused of being racist or unwelcoming, that the same people that probably harbored these opinions feel now that they could speak out, rather than more people becoming intolerant. I'm just interested in your views on that potential.
Yeah, Greg, I do respect their views as well. But my point is that we have to do more to make it clear that we need legal migrant workers here. So I also follow the social media and see that a lot of media comments, and I see the main reason, one of the main reasons behind the unrest is that locals are upset about the rise of asylum seekers in the recent years. With all due respect and sympathy for the asylum seekers and acknowledge they need protection, what I don't understand is why Indians are being targeted. We are high taxpayers.
But you know why? You know why? Because
1% of asylum seeker population.
But the reason why is because, and this is not, I'm not in any way justifying it, my word, no. What I'm saying, the reason why is that people associate asylum seeking with people of who aren't white, and you aren't white, and people see you, and they presume that you've just got off a coach having come into Dublin Airport yesterday. There is no distinguishing in some people's minds between people who have been living and working here or are second or third generation immigrants and asylum seekers. And that's the issue. I don't think enough necessarily has been done at government levels or in the maybe even public representatives and to some extent the media to distinguish between people who live and work here and have for some time and this is their home, and those that are coming here from another country through the IPAS system. That's the problem.
Yeah, I can understand that. That's where what I'm coming to. Like, we have to public representatives here, right? They must clearly communicate that the legal migration is essential to sustain the Ireland economy and public services. You can see that 78,500 Indians are on valid work visa, and they are here because there is a shortage of local workers. So and if you see 1 in 5 nurses in Ireland are Indians, about 18,500 professionals supporting the healthcare system. And IT and any sector you take, you know yourself, Greg, like there is a huge shortage of resources. We need more, right? 2,000 unfilled nurses post are here. 6,500 healthcare workers are needed by end of 2025. So and I'm not getting into all the details like construction and special needs services. We know there is a huge shortage. So what if the hate and fear continue to grow in Ireland, we risk losing the essential migrant workers. We have seen this happen before for different reasons. Between 2010 and 2015, each year, Greg, 80,000 people have left Ireland. you can check stats yourself. So what we have to do right from like the public leaders should enforce stricter laws against racial abuse to protect all community, share accurate facts to make it clear to the locals, like the contribution of local migrant workers and how they support Irish economy. And we also have to streamline the asylum approval process to ensure that people are accepted based on Ireland infrastructure.
The problem I envisage here, though, Anil, because politics is a very, very funny old thing, is that you will have noticed yourself a change in political parties' conversation and language and attitudes towards migrants, those coming fleeing other countries. The government would say many of them are. The government would say many are of them are coming over here only for financial reasons. The opposition might have said locally that, you know, Donegal has perhaps taken as many as we can manage. And I just wonder if they are going to bat for the likes of your community, because it might be very hard to articulate without the anti-immigration people going at them. So in other words, it's easier to say quiet than trying to distinguish between legal and illegal migration. And I think that is a challenge that politicians aren't necessarily up for.
Yeah, there should be more communications and initiatives, you know, to make it clear. So to wrap up my point, right? What I see, my like many of us have spent 15 to 20 years of our savings to buy a home or pay mortgages and settle here. And to be honest, we need safe and secure environment for our families, you know. So and we are looking forward to the politicians or whoever is the lawmakers to make strict, strong actions to protect migrant workers, Greg.
Okay, well, listen, thank you very much for joining us. I do appreciate your time. That is Anil Anthony of the Indian Community in Letterkenny. Your views to 086 60 25000, or in fact, give us a call on 074 91 25000. Joined on the programme now by Sinn Féin Councillor Jack Murray. Good morning, Jack. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Greg.
Right, now, you've been digging into some figures as it relates to the health service, specifically Letterkenny University Hospital, and it's that controversial issue of blood tests, Jack. What have you found?
Yeah, it's quite shocking. Actually, through parliamentary questions submitted by my colleague, Pierce Doherty, we've discovered that the outsourcing of just 5.5% of blood tests from Letterkenny University Hospital has been costing €1.2 million a year. And the HSE have also confirmed that if they were to do that in-house, it would have cost just over €100,000. So over €1.1 million annually is being spent to a private company. Now, all that is required to save that money is an extension to the current building. If they could do that, they could do that in-house and save over €1 million a year, €1 million that could be used elsewhere within our health service. If you think of the doctors, the nurses, the frontline staff, and care that is so badly required within the health system in Donegal, I just think it's crazy wastage of public funding.
Have we been able to, have we been able to find out at all what the delay is in seeking an extension or increasing testing capacity locally?
All that's been confirmed to us through this parliamentary question is that a form has been completed and it's been sent to the capital and estates section of the HSE, and it seems at that point it hasn't been approved. And they've confirmed that they've been aware of this for a number of years, and it's just sat there mothballing as far as I can see. So through your own show, I'd be appealing now to the HSE, please release this money, save the taxpayer money and invest this €1 million a year much more wisely where it's so badly needed.
Yeah, and you talked about sort of planning as well. This hasn't been thrust upon us. We have seen an increase in demand on the lab. So, you know, we perhaps should be planning more, especially when, you know, the taxpayers' money's on the table.
Absolutely. So since 2019, there was just under 4 million blood tests a year in Letterkenny Hospital. By 2024, that increased to over 7 million. So it was an increase of 78%. If that continues to increase, then the outsourcing will be further required. And again, there'll be more public money be invested into a private company. So we know it's there. We've known for years. But at this moment in time, I think now that it's public knowledge, I would hope that the pressure is on the HSE to act accordingly and just extend the pathology lab in Letterkenny University Hospital. Like it's
it would make you wonder what it must be like to work in there too, if they're so oversubscribed that the overwhelming majority are being sent out. The current resources and the current staff must be just at 110% the whole time.
Yeah, and they've been working to 2 a.m. in the morning. Even in the Department of Question and Response, it references staff burnout. So it's really unfair on our staff. And it's really unfair, particularly when we know the solution. We just know we need an extension in that building. It's there in front of our face. Like, it's not something we're trying to figure out. We know it's there. So we just need to front load the investment, extend the pathology lab, save this money and look after our staff who are on the front line.
Yeah, because we had obviously the recent controversy over the surgical hub, etc. This is sort of in house, isn't it? You know, this is not the same thing we're talking about here. This is about a facility that obviously has not grown to match the demand. You know, there are funds within the HSE and systems and what have you that should be, or if they haven't already, should be tapped into to make this a lab that's fit for demand.
Absolutely. It's all there. Everything's been completed. The form has been completed, sent to Capital and Estates. So we know the solution. We know what's required. We know that it'll save €1 million a year. We just need to release the money to do so.
Right,
it's,
okay.
It's an obvious
event. We'll make inquiries to the HSC to see the status of that application and how favourably they're looking at it. I must ask you, as you're a Buncrana rep, earlier on we had a conversation stroke debate with a local person who has approached people working on the development of an IPAS centre in Buncrana. As a result of that, they were told that if they continued to work there, their pictures would be taken, videos of them would be taken, they'd be posted on social media. And if they still didn't desist from working there, peaceful protests would be taking place outside their homes. And it seems to have been gathering quite a lot of attention nationally. Is this Buncrana? Is this what the people of Buncrana want?
No, not at all. No, I didn't hear the interview, but I'm aware of what's been said. People don't want that. And I'm always concerned that people are trying to stoke up tension, stoke up fear and division in the community. Look, and I have concerns of what's happening in St. Mary's Road. And even as recently as this morning, my colleague Paddy McLaughlin has made representations to the Department of Integration to see what the story is there, because it is clearly an over-intensification. But you wouldn't get planning permission for apartments there. So like, it's too much. But it's a step beyond to start following people home, intimidating them outside their house. And I would absolutely call on anybody not to engage in that type of activity at all. It's way beyond what I know. And now, the one person I know on your show has said that, but see, the people of Buncrana that I speak to, that's not representative of their beliefs at all.
Okay, thank you for that counterpoint. I appreciate it. That is Councillor Jack Murray, 086 60 25,000, our WhatsApp and our text number. Let us know what you think. Greg, getting rid of the triple lock is really simple to understand. Right now, we don't control our own military. Without it, we do. Is it our control of the military, or is it to sort of try and do what maybe the powers that be want us to do? I don't know. Greg, attacks on the Indian community or any community is disgraceful and un-Christian. They contribute so much to to every business in the country. Irish people went all over the world for work and a better life when Ireland had nothing to offer. Their own attacks on anyone is pure ignorance and much more. But I mean, listen, people who've lived here, and I've spoken to people who would be living here now for 10, 20 years, second generations, they themselves have concerns about access to resources, about their children being able to get a house or what have you. And they have also concerns about our current immigration policy. Just because you are of a certain heritage, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden your views don't align to that of a different cohort of people. It is kind of interesting. It's not hard to understand, but yeah. Greg, would this be the same Micheál Martin who said we would never go into a coalition with Fine Gael? The video is still probably floating about on YouTube. Now, they are best buddies, and the two parties are virtually indistinguishable from each other. I wouldn't put too much store by what Micheál says. Listen, I think all parties in a run-up to election want to stand on their own mandate and will distance themselves from potential coalition partners, but eventually end up in coalition with them. I think really on this fundamental sort of policy, the shift is slightly different because the very arguments that Micheál Martin was making in 2013 are the same arguments now that the opposition are being lambasted for. I get your point, and they are the same, but I also think they're a little bit different. Let the people decide if they want to change the triple lock, not the government. Thank you. Ask the question, we the people decide in a referendum. Come on, Greg. They're ruling out a referendum in relation to it. Sorry, I thought that question had been extensively asked and answered. It is such... I think anything that gives a power on any issue to the government of the day that has numbers whereby they effectively decide, I think for the public's sake, it would be good to have referendums on these matters. Maybe we should have some sort of a mechanism where a referendum isn't such a hoo-ha, you know, in the age of digital, whereby the public can be polled on certain issues in massive numbers, and that can help influence the direction the country goes in. I don't know. But it does seem like a big issue. Our neutrality for many people is incredibly important, and many people feel that this does dilute it. And I will say that in 2013, that was exactly the views of Micheál Martin. Such an interesting insight into autism from a wonderful young lady. Well done. Yes, she is brilliant, isn't she? Greg, just wanted to say well done to Caitlin. Thanks for being so brave in helping others with your podcast. I'm looking forward to listening to it, as I am. Another, I'm a volunteer with a loan. I'm making calls today, but can't get anyone. The phones must be down because of the storm. Can you mention this on your show, please? So that's someone having difficulties dialing out, so to speak. Can I have a mention, please, for a young boy from Glasgow who's on holidays just now at his gran's house in Farn? Matthew Anthony just received a Scottish exam result at 8 a.m. this morning, and he's now going to Glasgow University to study law and politics. Congratulations. Love from Mum, Dad, and wee brother Ryan Patrick. We're so proud of you. That's a couple of students from Scotland over on their hollybobs here at the moment getting some good news. Okay, brilliant. And you know what? Even if you didn't get the results you required, it might seem like the biggest deal at the moment. It doesn't matter a dot. It really, really doesn't. Trust me on that. All right, I'm going to be chatting to our friend Owen Corry, editor of Travel Extra, after a short break. Ryanair are getting rid of printed boarding passes. They're not going to be accepted from November 3rd. As I said at the start of the show, I haven't used one in I don't know, and it doesn't bother me. But that doesn't mean it doesn't bother quite a lot of people out there. Owen Corry, I think, might not like this idea. Owen Corry is editor of Travel Extra. Good morning to you, Owen. How are you keeping?
Good morning. Not bad at all. A lot of people, I think up to 20% of passengers, are still using paper boarding passes. When you think of all the different cultures that Ryanair deals with and the countries they fly to.
Yeah, that's a number much higher than I would have anticipated. And we kind of presume the picture that you might see at the boarding gate at Ireland West is the same in every airport or every country that Ryanair engage in. But clearly not. There's going to be cultural differences and access to technology, etc.
Absolutely. And, you know, it goes, there's a demographic. It's always a demographic mentioned. But there are a lot of younger people who do not engage with smartphones. They don't trust them. They just have had bad experiences with them and like that little bit of paper between their finger and their thumb. I did a forum at Holiday World show in January, and there were about 300 or 400 people at it for the Ryanair session. And it was rumoured at the time, there was no date set, it was going to be May originally, and there was a lot of anger by people. Michael O'Leary's response, as Michael O'Leary always does, is the granny will always find a grandchild who will get the boarding pass for them and sort it out for them. But the real goal here is he's driving the whole travel experience back to the Ryanair app, and where he's looking, he's surveying the death of traditional search engine that we, as we know it, with the emergence of AI, and he's saying that apps are the future. People, instead of going into Google, are going into an app on their smartphone, and he wants all of that to be within Ryanair. He wants the booking, the check-in, and the boarding pass to be within that. So that's really the goal at the end for him. Why is he doing a 25 minutes turnaround? That is the entire Ryanair business model. They offer the fares they do because each of their aircraft lands somewhere and takes off 25 minutes later. If that gets delayed, the business model is threatened. People foostering around for bits of paper tends to slow that down.
That being said, you know, batteries going flat, you know, screens darkening, apps closing. I see more fluttering sort of at the boarding gate with the phones. More the paper is just scanning away you go. But who am I to question Michael O'Leary? The thing is they must have done some internal numbers on this to sort of find, you know, whilst 20% might go for paper, how many of those just like that whole process of printing them out and having them and putting them in little booklets, and how many is it because they simply don't have a mobile phone or don't trust technology?
He says when the mobile battery runs down, once you've checked in, once they know who you are, and once you have the passport, you're getting on, which does raise the question, do we need boarding passes in the first place? But back to what Ryanair has successfully done, they do tend to set this deadline, this ultimatum. They did it, we're not serving coffee on board. Tony Ryan was still alive. He nearly lost it at the time. You can't fly without offering free coffee. Michael O'Leary persuaded him you could. He also said, we're going to charge for bags. There was absolute chaos, carnage at the time. You can't charge for a check-in bag. He did it, and he reduced the number of people who check in a bag from 80% of their passengers down to 20%. So he does have this self-fulfilling thing that he says something, everybody says it can never happen, and it does, and he's going for paperless boarding passes.
And of course, when you open the app now, it's very live, so when you open the app now, the baggage drop info's there, you can make adjustments to your seating, or you can get through a bit quicker, or you can pre-order your food. You can see why he keeps wanting to get eyes on that app. It will remain to be seen how successful it is. I mean, they're a juggernaut. They've just announced another month of record passengers, Owen. I mean, you know, they decide when we jump, and they also decide how high. And that's just the bottom line of it, it seems.
And 20.7 million of us jumped how high last month. It would have been higher even if the Boeing aircraft, he only got, he was short 25 aircraft that were supposed to come from Boeing, but the supply line meant it was, his growth is slower. It grew by about 3%. Ryanair carries as many passengers in 10 days as Aer Lingus does in a year. That's the scale he's at. When you look at the big airlines across Europe, though, not one of them is back to pre-pandemic. Lufthansa are about 97% there. Aer Lingus around 95%. Air France are about 90% of where they were in 2019. He's 40% ahead of where he was. That's the level of the way he aggressively tackles the market and he gets things done and he gets things moving, and he fights with people all the time. But passengers love it because the fares are absolutely terrific and there's nobody going to beat him on that.
Owen, what feedback are you getting, if it's only maybe anecdotal at this stage as we haven't seen the numbers, for the hotspots, you know, the usual places? I was, and I hadn't been away since before the pandemic, but I was in Salou and I was talking to some of the locals in the shops, and they weren't buying in products because the numbers were down so low, and I've heard similar reports from other places. Are you getting that impression, or are attitudes changing, or are less of us travelling, or maybe that was just, as I say, the views of a couple of people, and things are booming everywhere?
Things are not booming everywhere. Things are, the Irish outbound is very strong, thanks to Ryanair particularly, and Aer Lingus, who launched their own new app upgrade this morning as well. But the German market, on whom a lot of Spain depends, isn't back to pre-pandemic. As I say, Lufthansa isn't back. The Russian market was very important to Salou. It's completely gone. But there's more than 1.5 million people every year for the Salou region and Cambrille. They're all suffering. Ireland is about 20% ahead, really strong. The Spaniards love us at the moment. And the reason they love us is we're good spenders and we're good travellers. But as you say, it's not the same. It's been spotty across Europe. And the industry needs more predictability and consistency. If you're planning, if, you know, whatever about getting supplies in, if you're planning to extend your hotel, you really need some sort of notion of what's going to happen next. And that isn't happening across Europe. It's not going to be helped by the international situation and tariffs and the implications for the economy. But as I say, the Irish market, very, very strong for Spain and Portugal.
Yeah, I seem to be seeing every year or more consistent now temperatures in some of the most popular destinations in the very high 30s, mid 40s. It doesn't seem to be the weather. This seems to be the climate. Do you anticipate, I wonder, are they worried down there as maybe Northern Europeans or even people from Russia, if that situation is ever resolved, sort of saying, you know what, I like the sun, I like the heat, but that's actually just a little bit blooming hot for me. I'm going to look somewhere else.
Yeah, they're called sun holidays for a reason. It hasn't affected bookings at all. But there is, you know, if you're planning, as I say, economic investment, people are looking at what, what long term is, how it's happening long term with climate. It's less a problem with the sun results. They don't see the two heat waves that come through an El Nino pattern. They don't see that as being tremendously abnormal, though some of us are old enough to remember similar bunches of very hot summers back in the early 80s and mid 90s. But they, planning for everything has to be, in the tourism business, has to be predicated by how the market will react. And we don't see any implication for bookings out of heat waves. But you do see it in, for instance, the ski resorts of the Alps. Very, very hard to get anyone bank to lend you money if you're a more low-lying resort like Morzine to do an expansion at the moment, because they see the melt in the Alps going only one direction. The whole argument about climate change and sustainability, quite complex when it's applied to tourism. One heat wave doesn't change people's minds. It has to be longer term.
Yes, indeed. And that is a perfect example of a question being propagated on my experience, because I don't go skiing. So I would focus on the sun. Finally, towards late August into September, maybe even if we've managed to offload the kids back to school, or maybe they've left school and sodded off, where would be nice, August, maybe into September, Owen?
What seems to have happened is the airlines priced a little bit higher early in the year. They expected demand to be higher than it is, because it shouldn't be legal to open a school before September, first Monday in September.
I agree.
Bringing them back in August, that's shocking. That's mistreatment of children. But August 27, once those schools go back, you can get our trunk routes from Dublin, Malaga and Faro for €35 on Ryanair. Now, you will have to put all your clothes for the holidays in a small little bag. But once you, even if you pay the priority boarding and everything, it's really, really cheap. And that is a lot cheaper than it would have been in the summer, before the summer tapered out a couple of years ago. I do think they had too many seats. They didn't sell them, and the bots are kicking in and offering cheaper fares at the moment.
Okay.
You also keep an eye, on the new services from Derry Airport, which are always important in Donegal. And you've got three competing airlines in Belfast International, because Jet2, EasyJet and Ryanair are all competing on those big routes to Malaga, Faro, or the trunk routes, but all the other Spanish routes.
And it's local and to us as well. Brilliant, Owen.
Anywhere you have three airlines competing is really good for prices.
Owen, listen, I always love speaking to you. Thank you so very much. Owen Corry, editor of Travel Extra. Check out Travel Extra, by the way, for broad information on trips and what have you. That's where we leave it today. Great to be back with you after the longer weekend for some of us. We're back tomorrow morning at 9. But stay safe and stay tuned, because Donna Marie Doherty is around the Northwest all this week. That's coming up after the news at 12.